House Committee on Judiciary, February 10th, 1987, Subcommittee 3, House Bill 2324, relating to civil commitments.
Call this hearing to order. This is the House Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee 3. It appears, and this is a carryover hearing of House Bill 2324, otherwise known as the Civil Commitment Bill. We have a pretty full house today, and I'd like to just get started and get on with our testimony. For our first witness, we have Mayor Sue Miller of the city we're in. And Madam Mayor, anyone else you wish to bring up with you?
I think I'll do it at this point, and we'll see if there are questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman Hanlon and committee members. I appreciate being able to speak today concerning House Bill 2324 and expressing the City of Salem's support for this bill. I want to put a great big disclaimer at the very beginning and say neither I nor the city is in the mental health business, and we are not here to present ourselves as experts in this field or experts in helping you solve what is obviously a very large and complex problem. What I wanted to do today, and I will be brief in this, is to share with you some of the concerns that we have as the community that is the home, obviously, of Oregon State Hospital, as well as several other state institutions, and share a few facts with you as far as the impact of having OSH in our community as it relates, obviously, to civil commitment legislation. I also want to commend the members of the Task Force on Civil Commitment and the members of the Legislative Oversight Task Force and the Multnomah County Task Force for the groundwork that has been laid to bring all of us to this point today. The deinstitutionalization of many mentally ill people has had a direct impact upon the public safety and certainly the social services that many cities in this state need to provide. The City of Salem, we believe, has shouldered a disproportionate responsibility for these clients because of the presence of OSH here. Just last September, we, along with six other jurisdictions in this area, contracted with the Bureau of Governmental Research out of Eugene to do a study looking at the impact of institutions on this general area in the Mid-Willamette Valley. The preliminary results, which are out, and if you are interested in seeing the details, we would be glad to supply copies, confirmed our fear that Salem has been disproportionately impacted by the state institutions. And it's primarily because of the discharges and because of the release policies that the institutions have. The Salem area has received the largest number of patient discharges relative to population from all four of the OSH programs. In 1986, we had 754 persons discharged into our area from the general psychiatric wards at the three state hospitals. These discharges amounted to 20.3 readmissions per 10,000 population in our community. The next closest community is the Portland metropolitan area with 9.6 per 10,000 as opposed to 20.3 per 10,000 in Salem. The Marion County Mental Health Department estimates that there are 3,000 chronically mentally ill in the county, with the majority living in Salem. The state of Oregon currently provides funding to the county for approximately 10%. But 324 of this target population. We also have recently done a survey and a study in Salem looking at our homeless population, which is obviously another growing concern in the state as well as the country. And it indicates that 28% of our homeless in this community are chronically mentally ill. Once again, a very direct correlation between having the institutions here and having a really great need in our community to service these people. Our city council has pledged some resources, mostly through our federal money, to try to build a shelter for the mentally ill, but that is only going to be a really very small part of the program. The Salem Police Department estimates that at least 10% of their time is spent dealing with mentally and emotionally disturbed individuals. and I have a feeling, and they would confirm, that that is probably a very conservative estimate. Recently on Christmas Eve, there was one of the mentally ill clients who went through City Hall and broke a number of windows, including mine. As is the case in many counties these days, he was back on the streets within 72 hours. So not obviously being detained very well by the court system, also not being treated very well by the entire mental health institutions. In these instances, there's little that we can do for the individuals, and it doesn't seem that the treatment programs are in place to help them either. And another side of this, which we don't have very good figures on yet, but it's one we will be looking into, is the whole issue of how do we protect these chronically mentally ill people who are on our streets. Our police department has recently estimated that 30% of all the sex crimes committed in Salem are committed on these people. They are the victims of 30% of the sex crimes. So it's not only looking after the majority of our population's welfare, we believe we need to look after the mentally ill people's welfare as well. We have a situation in which the chronically mentally ill must become very dangerous to others before they can be dealt with in a commitment situation. This results in a disruption of community life and places a burden upon our police, our neighborhoods, and also our taxpayers. We believe that by extending the commitment criteria as outlined in this bill to allow for early intervention, you will help protect the public safety of all of our citizens. We believe that the early commitment and extending the commitment criteria, as well as providing for better treatment programs, will go a long way toward remedying a very, very severe situation. So on behalf of our city council and the residents in the greater Salem area, I urge your support of House Bill 2324, and obviously also a commitment on a financial basis to see that it's funded adequately so it can be implemented. Thank you.
Questions, Mayor Miller? Representative Dix.
I have two questions.
Yes, sir.
First question is, I'm concerned that when we get into a discussion of involuntary and voluntary and the amount of money that's needed for both, that this bill doesn't properly address the question of someone who steps forward voluntarily that needs help, and those people turn into involuntary commitment cases later on. And I just wondered if you had any feelings about that, or if it seems to me this is a good bill and probably one that's needed, but we don't address the other half of the question within the confines of this measure.
The other half being the finances, you
right.
mean? I certainly share that concern, and I obviously haven't dealt with the finances, and actually Marion County would be in a better position to give you some data on financially what it means to us locally. But you're certainly right. This bill is obviously a step forward, but without the money to enforce it and make it happen, you probably should forget this bill too. So the other side of the equation is going to be absolutely critical to this.
The other question I would have, we heard from the District Attorneys Association at the end of the last hearing, and it was suggested, and I would be happy to stand corrected, but it was suggested that this measure would only cost them money and really wouldn't help them in terms of prosecution, that there aren't that many cases that come through the system that are perpetrated by people who would fall under the guise of this bill, or the umbrella of this bill. Is that your statistics seem to indicate just the opposite, that if we passed this measure and folks were confined, that would drive down the crime rate? Is that a conclusion on my part that's not fair, or?
Representative Dix, I would just indicate that Dale Penn was the person speaking for the District Attorneys Association.
Right, and he is the Marion County DA, as you know, so I wouldn't want to conflict with what our DA said. However, we are assuming that you, Representative Dix, are correct in your analysis that there will be a correlation between crime rate and the number of these people who are literally on the streets without the proper supervision or probably medication and care in many cases.
My concern at that time, and I expressed in the hearing, was that although it may mean that the DAs need more money, then in fact by getting these people into the system, they're not going to be out there committing crimes, which would cause the DAs to prosecute them, which is not ongoing. That in fact there may be a savings at some point, and I don't think I got my point across that afternoon, but your feeling is there possibly might be a savings in the long run, to all concern.
We sure hope there is. That's certainly a major contention behind our position on this bill.
Thank you.
I'll have to talk to Dale.
We note that we do get disproportionate representation in the state process from Marion County, and that may have to do with proximity.
Yeah, we have noted that on our own city staff. I think every professional we have is representing his or her professional organization for lobbying this year, and we have some concerns about that also.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I have a note from last time for carryover for a representative of the League of Women Voters. Is Catherine Eaton here?
Do you want your sign-up sheet?
Oh, we have another one out there. Thank you.
Representative Hanlon, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Eaton. I reside at 1631 East 24th Avenue in Eugene. I'm currently chair of the League of Women Voters of Oregon Mental Health Committee. We have just completed a 16-month study on the adult mental health system in Oregon, out of which came a research report, which I will provide the committee a copy of. The League is the only multi-issue non-special interest group to study and report on adult mental health in Oregon. The League supports an adult mental health commitment process, which first ensures statewide consistency in the application of commitment statutes, secondly provides for adequate and equitable investigation and examination, and third, protects the rights and needs of all interested parties. As an official observer during the Civil Commitment Task Force proceedings, the League both read and heard the testimony of judges, family members, examiners, investigators, defense attorneys, district attorneys, community mental health program directors, and clients of the mental health system. We support the provisions of House Bill 2324, which will provide investigators with the opportunity for increased information about the immediate problems of the allegedly mentally ill person, and which will provide for more adequate examinations prior to commitment hearings. Access to medical records for the current detention period will provide a better basis for commitment decisions by the court, as well as provide for consideration of the rights of the allegedly mentally ill and interested parties. House Bill 2324 also addresses some of the inconsistencies in the application of the commitment statutes as currently constituted. All holds of allegedly mentally ill persons would be of the same duration. The state would be required to present its case in court. Investigators would be allowed access to the courtroom, and examiners would be ensured reasonable time to work with the client prior to a hearing. Recurring problems in these areas were cited by numerous members of the panels appearing before the task force. The League supports the modest broadening of the commitment criteria to allow for early intervention when a chronically mentally ill person is deteriorating. Since our position strongly favors the provision of crisis, residential, treatment, and support services in the community, the inclusion in the governor's proposed budget of funds which will increase community services for the chronically mentally ill and thus fund the commitment revisions is both timely and welcome. We urge the subcommittee to recommend passage of House Bill 2324 to the full Judiciary Committee.
Questions of Catherine?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Greg Sullinger, who was a sign-up from last time. Charlie? You're a carryover, you're on. I must tell everybody that Mr. Williamson has signed up for the ACLU, and there's a little box here that says for, and that's checked, and there's a little box here that says against, and that's checked.
Maybe we're a little schizophrenic today. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the ACLU was represented on the task force which drafted House Bill 2324. I served as an alternate.
Charlie, would you, for the purpose of the record...
Charles Williamson. I'm an attorney from Portland, 520 Southwest Yamhill, Portland, Oregon. We generally support this bill, except we have three major problems. We do commend Dr. Bray and Roxy Hello and Mike Kopetsky in the Mental Health Division for their tremendous efforts at trying to gain a consensus among all interested parties. We have these concerns. We oppose any expansion of the commitment criteria. The state is now unable to care for the mentally ill persons found to be dangerous to themselves or to others or unable to meet their basic personal needs. To add 400 less mentally ill persons to the hospital population seems unfair, both to those already committed and to those non-dangerous persons meeting their own needs, who will be given the dubious privilege of incarceration in overpopulated facilities and involuntarily administered personality-altering drugs. I understand that just last month, Damish rescheduled its certification visit so that they could be again eligible for Medicare funding of somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 a month. The committee should note that the Mental Health Division has refused to admit mentally ill people to Damish or other state hospitals who request admission voluntarily. This is a catch-22 situation. If you want to get in, you're not sick enough to get treated. If you do want to get in, if you don't want to get in, you're sick and you must be treated. Would it not be wiser to allocate scarce resources to people who want treatment and who can therefore be more easily helped than to forcibly impose treatment on an unwilling class of non-dangerous people? I have often felt that judges in administering this law take the position that if in doubt, commit. They feel it won't do a person who's not mentally ill, a little stay in the hospital won't hurt him.
Let me ask a question.
Yes, sir.
Hopefully it's not a hypothetical, but you say those non-dangerous persons meeting their own needs in your written testimony. Are there people in the expanded criteria put into this bill that might be more dangerous to others than those whose needs need to be met but aren't being met but aren't dangerous to others? And do we as a state have a duty not only to this population but to the overall society of this state to protect it from the dangerousness of the potential dangerousness caused by having these people not under direct supervision?
Well, if someone is dangerous, we have no, to themselves or to others, I have no problem with them being committed. They should be. If it's a situation where a judge or an examiner is saying, well, we think this person's going to be dangerous sometime, you're not just, if you knew, and if it could be predicted exactly which 400 people we're talking about, these 400 people are going to be dangerous, no question about it. There's not much of a civil liberties issue there, but it's not just those 400 people. It's the courts and the psychiatrists, psychologists, examiners picking out which ones they are. And this criteria, the way you've got it, I was coming to this, but doctor, when you try and put a definition on who it's going to be and you try and define what an episode is, Dr. Bray talked for about 2 minutes about what an episode was. I'd suggest you get that typed up and read it, and then you figure how judges and examiners around the state are going to define episode and how they're going to be, you know, well, we'll just take the benefit of the doubt in favor of commitment. You're going to have quite a broad commitment standard, at least for people that have been in the hospital before.
That's so your representation is that the wording in the bill that the person is in an episode of either mental or physical deterioration that is likely to result in that person becoming a danger to others, that wording's just too wide open for your liking, the organization you represent.
That's correct. And I think, you know, depending on who's interpreting that wording and applying it to the behavior, I would say there's probably at least a million people in the state, and maybe everybody in the state has been in that situation at one time or another. And the other point about a stay in a mental hospital, that people do lose jobs, they do lose their apartments. Some people, when they're operating fairly close to the edge anyway, and they are disrupted like that, they never become independent again. So there is some harm done if somebody is committed.
Representative Dix.
I don't want to belabor this point all afternoon, but it essentially what Mr. Williamson has said at this, in the last three paragraphs, is what I'm concerned about within this bill, that we address the involuntary, not the voluntary, that in fact many times the work that was done in the interim indicates that voluntary becomes involuntary at a later point, and we're not taking care of those people in this bill. So just for the record, I am very concerned about the measure as it stands, and that it is simply a stopgap. It is the first step, and it really doesn't address the problem. So those voluntaries will become, in many instances, dangerous involuntary cases, and they are knocking on our doors at this point, from what I understand. So excuse me for interrupting.
Thank you. Our second major concern is the elimination of the physician psychotherapist patient privilege in sections 1 and 2 of the bill. We do not think that any privilege has been more sacrosanct than a person's communication with his or her doctor. To permit all medical records and all communications between a doctor and a patient into evidence in commitment proceedings will hinder treatment by making communication of serious problems less likely and will constitute a gross invasion of the privacy of allegedly mentally ill people. And please note that it's not just mentally ill people who will have this privileged waive. It's everybody that's accused or brought before the court. Even if the case is dismissed, they will have had that privileged waived.
Let's slow down there for a minute. Sections 2 and 3 on privileges, can you just point out exactly what it is you're speaking to? Did you say 2 and 3?
1 and 2.
Okay.
Lines,
I think 1 and 2 are the ones that apply.
Lines 13 to 18, essentially, on page 2 and 6 through 11 on page 3. It just takes away that privilege. It doesn't exist for those sorts of proceedings.
The references are to what? The ORS references?
That's to the commitment proceedings, 426.
My understanding is that from the testimony we've had previously, and you were here, from the proponents of this bill, that loosening of the privilege would only be with regard to the beginning of the episode forward.
That's correct, I apologize, Representative Hamlin. I think we would still...
That was my understanding of the testimony we had. We may have to go back and take another very close look at that.
Uh, Well, maybe that's true. I'll check that through myself as well and let you know.
I wish you would follow up on that one. And whether or not that would make a difference in your in the ACLU's position.
No, it wouldn't, to the extent that it's waived. It certainly would be much less objectionable if that's the limit of it, though. But again, it's our understanding, and I don't know, I didn't hear all the testimony that you've heard, but I haven't heard evidence of cases where people were let go who were dangerous and it couldn't be proven because you couldn't have these records. I mean, to me it seems it's been an inconvenience, a bother, but it hasn't actually interfered with the proper administration of the law.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bellamy.
Yeah, I can ask a question here. How do you define dangerous?
Well, somebody's going to hurt themselves or hurt another person. Generally, I would say inflict bodily harm.
But we'll have testimony and testimony and testimony that under that definition, the individual should have been committed, and they're saying that our law doesn't allow it. But they have to be proven dangerous. And I would guess that your organization would be in there very careful about the process of the labeling of dangerous. In other words, I guess I'm really asking, is your organization taking the cop-out by saying that we think a dangerous person ought to be committed, but in reality you would never allow us to use a definition of dangerous?
We think a dangerous person should be committed, and we would allow you to use a definition of dangerous. I haven't seen anyone. I don't think that the problem has been in defining dangerous. It's defining whether or not dangerousness was proven or shown by clear and convincing evidence. The law. And I think, Representative Bellamy, most cases it's people saying we think that this person is dangerous, but they haven't really done anything. They may have acted in a different way, but they haven't really done anything to indicate that they are going to hurt themselves or hurt other people. And as with most mentally ill people, the vast majority of them, they aren't dangerous. They're harmless, and they're not, and they are meeting their own needs, and they don't want to go into the hospital. In many cases. And I guess you've got to carve out, from the state's point of view, you've got to carve out a group of people that you are going to involuntarily commit, because you can't commit all of them. I mean, you don't have anywhere near the resources to commit them all. And we think the line is in, from a civil liberty standpoint, in the right place. And I think it's in the right place from the state's funding standpoint, and from what's the standpoint of what's who you need to commit to best protect society. I mean, I'd be glad to work on the definition a little more, if dangerous, on the definition of dangerous, if you want, if that's a problem. I just wanted to add on this point in my testimony, I don't believe that we'd have any problem with the introduction of communications by a person or by a physician or psychotherapist to appropriate authorities or to the court to show that someone was about to commit a crime or to hurt someone. The third problem with HB 2324 is the reduction in the number of examiners from 2 to 1 and the conduct of the examination outside the purview of the court and possibly counsel. Under present law, 2 examiners examine an alleged mentally ill person in open court where a judge can see what kind of job they do in their examination. One of the examiners must be a physician. Under the proposed law, you only have 1 examiner who need not be a physician. Under HB 2324, an allegedly mentally ill person can request a second examination, which would be helpful, but is nevertheless going to be both costly and cumbersome because it's going to be conducted outside of court at a separate time, most likely from the first examination. Under the present system, the judge and counsel can see if the examiner's do a careful and complete job of assessing the problems of the allegedly mentally ill person, and the defense attorney can find out what kind of questions he wants to ask the examiner in cross-examination. What did you ask him? What didn't you ask him? Why didn't you ask him these things? Were you aware of these things in his background? It's an important thing to be there. If the judge and counsel are going to have the benefit of the same knowledge under the new law, they will all have to attend the out-of-court examinations of the two examiners, most likely conducted at separate times. The attorney, judge, and examiner time under the new proposal is virtually double. The examiner is going to have to go to the examination outside of court and then come to court. Even worse, it seems to cheapen the importance of the commitment proceeding by lessening the degree of expertise required for commitment. In the future, people will be committed upon the judgment of only one non-physician examiner. There seems to be a wide impression among the members of the public that more people should be locked up and that this would generally help improve the safety of the public. The presence of bag ladies, alcoholics, and homeless people on our streets is sometimes cited as a problem requiring more people to be committed to mental hospitals. While these do constitute problems for which we should seek a solution, involuntary commitment is probably not a significant factor in resolving them. Our present mental commitment law was enacted in essentially its same form as it is now in 1973. It has been amended on only a few occasions to make it easier to commit people since that time. Specifically in 1979, the standard...